His father was there, as big and robust as when he had last seen him when Will was just 11 years old, and he was leading Spades as he walked toward him. Familiar sights of his boyhood home surrounded him, and he knew he was back in Missouri.
Hello, Pa. I reckon I've come home.
You ain't done a hell of a lot with your life up to now, have you, son? I reckon you're a pretty good scout, but what the hell are you gonna do when the Injuns are all on the reservation?
Will paused to look all around him and discovered that he was no longer in Missouri, but back in Kansas again.
I don't know, Pa, but it don't look like it matters much since I'm up here with you now.
We ain't ready for you yet, son. You got a lot more to do before you're through down there. Don't worry about Spades. I'll take care of him for you.
He was aware of a deep feeling of disappointment as his father's image faded away with the light that had shone for a moment, but was now gone. Not sure whether he was in heaven or hell, Will slowly opened his eyes to see the light again, realizing then that the light was the sun peeking over the eastern horizon.
Ugh!
A stinging pain in his side told him that he was still alive, and upon blinking away the veil of sleep from his eyes, he saw that he was still lying against some tree roots, one hell of a long way from heaven or hell. The dream he had didn't come to mind. Forcing himself to shift his body slightly in order to look behind him in the creek bed, he at once felt a stab of grief when he saw Spade's carcass.
I'm sorry, old friend.
He looked beyond the horse to the body of one of the men who had attacked him. He remembered then, Ned Spikes, although wounded, had escaped.
Good thing. For if he hadn't, he could have easily finished me off while I was asleep.
Will spent a brief thought on Braxton, wondering if the bewildered lieutenant had been able to find Fort Larned. Looking down at the bloody mess that had crusted his shirt, he started to reach for it, but was stopped abruptly by a sharp pain in his shoulder. He had forgotten that he was wounded there as well. Only then aware that he was still holding his rifle, he laid it aside and used that hand to examine the wound in his side. After a great deal of effort, he managed to pull his shirt away from the ugly hole left by the bullet. The blood had plastered the fabric of his shirt to the wound, causing him considerable pain to separate the two and starting the flow of blood anew. Realizing for the first time that the pain he experienced ran through him all the way to his back, he felt behind him and found an exit wound. The bullet had gone all the way through. He then promptly felt the back of his shoulder to see if the same had happened there. It had not.
I should have known that. It feels like I got a 5-pound ball of iron in my damn shoulder.
He had been so sure that he was going to die before he passed out last night, but now it seemed that death was not ready for him. One of the things that convinced him of that was his desire for food. Although still reluctant to move, he told himself that he had to force his body to obey him. With his good hand, he took hold of a tree root and strained to pull himself up on his feet. Then he reached down and picked up his rifle. Using it as a walking stick, he slowly made his way over to Spade's carcass, where he sat down on the dead horse's quarters and took his canteen from the saddle. Suddenly realizing how thirsty he was, he downed a good portion of the contents, but then he paused to wait a few minutes, as if expecting the water to stream out through the holes in his body. When that failed to happen, he decided that it was all right to eat something. Evidently, the bullet had not punctured any internal organs. Will moved slowly to the remains of the campfire, where he found a large slab antelope hump lying in the ashes. He brushed it off and ate as much as he could hold. The major portion of the antelope had not yet been cooked and was most likely too far spoiled to salvage. The small quantity of roasted meat would soon turn as well, so food, in spite of being in great supply, would not be fit to eat. Feeling tired from the simple motions of taking food and water, he sat down and leaned back, using Spade's croup as a backrest. He decided there was nothing he could do about his wounds other than trying to contain the bleeding. Then there was concern about the third member of the Bushwhackers. He was sure he'd wounded Spikes in the leg, but the question he couldn't answer was would he return to see if Will was still alive. There was a lot for a murderer to come back for: saddles, weapons, ammunition. And would he return with others? At any rate, Will decided that he couldn't remain there waiting to heal on his own.
Come hook or crook, I'm gonna have to walk to Fort Larned.
It was not a promising decision, but he felt he had little choice but to try.
Oh, die here, or die on the way to the fort. Not a hell of a lot of difference.
Forcing his every move as he struggled to prepare for the trek to Fort Larned, he filled his canteen with water, then removed one saddlebag to carry what food he decided was all right to eat. There was a small quantity of hardtack left that would do in a pinch, so he put that in the bag as well. He took his extra revolver from his saddlebag and stuffed it in his belt, draped a cartridge belt over his injured shoulder and the saddlebag over the other one, and still using his rifle as a cane, he took a few steps toward the creek to test his steadiness. The weakness in his legs almost caused him to sit back down immediately, but he fought the urge, fearing that if he sat down, he might not be able to get back up. Running on willpower alone, he forced himself to concentrate on one step at a time as he entered the cool water of the creek. Fighting against a current that he wouldn't even have noticed before, he managed to make it to the other side, and then up the bank, ignoring the fresh bleeding from both wounds. Once he'd gained the other side, he stood for a moment, soaking wet from the waist down, and he stared out at the prairie before him.
Hell, it ain't but 25 miles.
It was early morning before reveille when Braxton reached Fort Larned. The private on guard duty didn't know what to make of the sudden appearance of a greatly disheveled lieutenant riding bareback on an exhausted horse. But he directed him to post headquarters, where Braxton explained his unlikely arrival to the officer of the day, Lieutenant Chad Williams. After hearing Braxton's tale of his escape from a Cheyenne camp, his wound treatment at Fort Hays, and his narrow escape from an attack on Walnut Creek, Williams insisted that the surgeon should look at his wound.
Lieutenant Williams, it is extremely important that I return to Fort Dodge as soon as possible. My wound is healing fine, and I don't want to waste any more time before reporting back.
I'm sure Colonel Thompson would advise a visit to the doctor after what you've been through. You should take the opportunity to rest here before you think about heading back to Fort Dodge.
Look, Williams, Chad, is it?
Yes.
Look, Chad, you seem to be someone I can confide in. I was supposed to be married right after that mission to attack the Cheyenne village. My fiancée doesn't even know if I'm alive or dead. I need to get back right away. Surely you can understand my anxiety to return to her.
Well, I certainly can understand your hurry. I guess I would be, too. I'm sure the colonel will understand as well.
The lieutenant was accurate in his anticipation of the colonel's reaction to Braxton's ordeal.
My God, man! It's a miracle you've made it back.
A man of understanding and compassion for the gentle pleasures of life. The colonel understood Braxton's urgency to return to Dodge and the grieving lady who prayed for his safe return.
If you're sure your wound is healed enough to make the trip, I'll send a detail to escort you back right away. Today, if that's your wish.
It is, sir.
But you've ridden all night. Are you sure you don't want to wait until you've had time to rest?
I'm ready to go today.
Damnation. I wish I was young again. I'll tell you what. We'll detail an ambulance to take you back. You can rest on the trip.
Thank you, sir. I guess I'm thinking with my heart instead of my head.
Hell, nothing wrong with that. What became of the civilian scout that was with you?
He was killed at Walnut Creek.
After tending to his leg, which turned out to be barely more than a flesh wound, Ned Spikes returned to the campsite to see what he could scavenge. He was able to find his ex-companion's horses in the nearby brush, expecting to find the body of the man who had killed his two associates. He was shocked to see a bloody trail leading away from the camp. Thinking it best not to leave any loose ends, he decided to track the man down and put him in the ground for good. It wasn't a hard trail to follow. The footprints, labored and unsteady, scuffed the grass and dragged through the bare spots. Ned pictured the walking dead man trying to make it all the way to Fort Larned on foot, knowing that he would overtake him before another night came.
He's mighty damn considerate. When he don't drag his feet, he leaves a little trail of blood on the grass.
As he predicted, it was late in the afternoon when he spotted a circle of three buzzards hovering over the prairie beyond a low rise several hundred yards away.
Didn't get very far, did you?
Coming to the rise, he noticed a change in the trail he followed. The blades of grass still bent over indicated that a saddlebag Will had been carrying was now being dragged behind him.
Won't be long now.
Before crossing over the rise, he paused to survey the range ahead. He could see where the buzzards were circling, but he was unable to spot the object of their attention. Prodding his horse, he rode to the top of the rise and paused to look again. And then he saw what he was looking for. A body lying still in a shallow gully, just a few dozen yards short of a little stream. He shook his head and smiled.
You almost made it to water, didn't you? Too damn bad.
Still unwilling to abandon all caution, he held his rifle up, ready to fire as he walked his horse slowly toward the body. There was a saddlebag lying on the ground a few yards short of the gully, further evidence that the man was finished. Ned took his eye off of the body for only an instant to take notice of it. He stopped his horse beside the gully, and he sat there with his rifle aimed at Will's back as he lay face down, his rifle under him. After a few minutes ticked slowly by with no response from the body, Ned lowered his rifle and dismounted.
Will Kaysen, did you think I was going to let you get away with killing my partners and shooting me in the leg? I swear, though, I am disappointed to see you died before I had a chance to put a bullet in your head.
His attention drawn then to the Henry rifle lying beneath the body, he reached down, grabbed Will's arm, and rolled him over. The wicked grin on Ned's face was suddenly replaced by a look of startled horror caused by the .44 revolver in Will's hand, the muzzle of which was pointed directly at his face.
I'd hate to disappoint you, Spikes.
Although free of further worry about Ned Spikes, the incident brought a new and immediate, although temporary, problem. With a bullet in his brain, Ned's body landed on top of Will to lay across his stomach and hips. Weary to the point of exhaustion only a few short minutes before, Will's disgust for having the body of the vile bushwhacker draped upon him was incentive enough to summon the energy necessary to shove the corpse from him. Calling upon all the reserve determination he possessed, he sat up and took a fresh look at his circumstances. There was new bleeding from his wounds, but it wasn't excessive. Ned's horses had spooked when Will's pistol went off, but they hadn't gone far. This helped to bolster his determination now with the possibility of riding instead of walking. He was in no shape to chase after the horses, but hopefully they would come wandering back. With painful effort but new resolve, he got to his feet and walked back a few yards to recover the saddlebag he had dropped. Then he turned and began slowly limping toward the stream some 50 yards away. The horses remained still, watching him. After a moment, the gray turned and ambled casually after him as he had hoped. The other two followed slowly after him. As soon as he got to the water, he took hold of the gray's reins before dropping to his belly and drinking beside the horse. The gray did not seem to mind. When he had his fill, Will struggled to his feet again and stroked the horse's neck while it continued to drink.
I believe you're gonna be all right, boy. It ain't none of your fault that your last owner was a sorry son of a bitch.
Will's next concern was climbing into the saddle. He wasn't sure he had the strength to do it, but he told himself he was determined to die trying. Once he was seated in the saddle, he decided that he was there to stay. He was not planning to dismount until he reached Fort Larned, for he figured it wasn't worth the pain to go through it again. It felt good to be seated in his saddle, but something didn't feel right, and he realized that Spikes had shortened the stirrups a little.
Hell, it'll have to do, because that shirt of God ain't gonna change him now.
He looped the reins of the other two horses around the saddle horn. Taking a look at where the sun was in the afternoon sky, he turned the gray gelding toward a line of distant hills to the southeast and let the horses settle into a comfortable pace. He had traveled through this part of the territory a few times before, but not enough to recognize landmarks. In the weakened state he had been in, he couldn't accurately estimate how far he'd walked before dropping into that gully. But he could well guess that it had not been very far, so he prepared himself for a ride of more than 15 miles. His sense of reckoning, even in these dire circumstances, was dead on as usual. He struck the Pawnee Fork of the Arkansas after dark and followed it into Fort Larned, barely able to remain upright in the saddle. The sentry on duty took one look at the blood-covered rider.
Sergeant of the Guard, post number 3!
The sentry tried to help Will down from his horse.
Hold on, soldier. You best leave me be till I can get to the doctor. If I get down, I ain't sure I can get back on.
The private stepped back away from his stirrup, not sure what he should do, and wondering if he should lead the wounded man's horse to the hospital, while knowing he was not supposed to leave his post. He was saved from making the decision, however, because the sergeant of the guard came running on the double. While the sergeant was assessing the situation, the officer of the day arrived to assume command of the situation.
He's a scout out at Fort Dodge, sir. He's a scout that lieutenant who showed up was talking about.
Well, I'll be damned. He said you were dead.
Might be I am. I ain't sure to tell you the truth.
Let's get you over to the surgeons.
The lieutenant took hold of the gray's bridle and started leading him toward the hospital. Will was not in a state to remember much about what happened after that, except that he found himself on a hospital bed with a doctor probing about on his side and shoulder. He'd be told that he had passed out when they got him off the horse, and he was trying to pull his rifle from the saddle scabbard. Although dead to the world, he had still made a feeble effort to keep him from taking his rifle from him. Beside him now, the doctor probed a little too deep.
Well, I see you're awake. All I can say is you must have one hell of a strong constitution. I expect you haven't got a canteen cup full of blood left in you.
How long have I been here?
Just since last night. You feel like eating anything?
I usually do.
I'll order some breakfast for you. Tell you the truth, I thought last night that I'd be ordering a burial for you this morning.
I reckon they ain't ready for me yet, in heaven or hell.
Then the thought struck him that he had dreamed something about that, but he couldn't recall the details of it.
There was a lieutenant ahead of me. Did he make it back here?
That he did, and he's already gone, on his way to Fort Dodge to get married. I looked at him briefly, but he wasn't going to stay, no matter what I said. I hope you're not thinking about going after him, because you're not in any condition to go anywhere for a good while yet.
Will shook his head, satisfied that his obligation for Braxton's well-being had now been discharged.
Hell no. I ain't in no hurry to go anywhere.
Later in the evening, Lieutenant Chad Williams stopped by the hospital to see him.
I was officer of the day when Lieutenant Bradley rode in. From what he told me, you two had quite a battle on your hands. I know you must have been glad to hear that he made it here all right.
Oh, yeah. I'm plumb tickled.
He thought you were dead. I don't expect he would have left you if he'd known you weren't. You'll really be surprised to find out you made it. Probably would have waited here for you. Maybe not, though. He was mighty anxious to get back, and I expect his fiancée will be really happy to see him safely back in her arms.
I expect.
Will was grateful when the colonel came in, effectively changing the subject. The colonel's visit was no more than a courtesy call, but he did question Will on the location and strength of the Cheyenne camps before getting around to asking about the men who had attacked him and Bradley at Walnut Creek. When he learned the identity of the three bushwhackers, he was not surprised.
We've been looking for those three for quite a while. Several ranchers have been hit by them, and we always seem to be just a day or two behind them. So I guess you've taken care of the Army's business as far as Ned Spikes and his henchmen are concerned.
Always tickled to help the Army.
With no particular desire to return to Fort Dodge, Will was an ideal patient for a few days, content to sleep and eat and do little more. Always a fast healer, he began to recover rapidly near the end of the week, so he started thinking about making plans to report back to Camp Supply. He had still not fully regained his strength, but he was strong enough to take an interest in the three horses he now owned. When he first went to the stables to check on them, he was immediately able to recognize the gray gelding that had once belonged to Ned Spikes, and he was reasonably sure of the little paint mare that one of Spikes' partners rode. But he had to admit that he would not have been able to pick out the other one without help. He wasn't seeing anything too clearly on that ride. Making idle conversation with one of the soldiers on stable duty one afternoon while watching his horses feed, he suddenly remembered a promise he had casually made to Emma. He decided he needed to work with a little paint. The thought brought a smile of pleasure to his face until it occurred to him that he'd have to go back to Fort Dodge to deliver the gift. He'd already decided to bypass Dodge on his way back to Camp Supply. The idea of seeing the newlyweds this soon after the wedding was not something he cared to experience. He was afraid he couldn't hide his feelings if he saw Sarah, and he had no reason to want to see Braxton Bradley ever again, and he was sure the feeling was mutual. He knew it was unrealistic to think about avoiding Bradley and Fort Dodge if he continued working as a scout, but he did hope to delay the encounters until a little time had passed so maybe he wouldn't feel like a damn fool if he ran into Bradley or Sarah. All those thoughts made him feel restless, and he decided that he'd laid around Fort Larned long enough. It was too much damn time for thinking. He needed to get back on a horse and head to the open country. The next morning was too pretty to waste sitting around an army post, so Will decided it was time to take his leave. The fact that the chaplain had left that morning on his way to Fort Dodge to hold his monthly service there had not improved Will's mood, especially when one of the hospital orderlies had remarked that the chaplain had said that he had a wedding to conduct. So, with the briefest of goodbyes to the staff at the hospital, he collected his belongings and made his way over to the stables. Another private was on stable duty, one he'd not met before.
I'm going to pick up my horses and get them out of your way.
You the scout from Fort Dodge?
The private walked to the tack room with Will to help him with his gear.
I am.
That'll be the gray yonder, the paint, and the chestnut, right?
That's right.
With the private helping, they got a bridle on each one. As Will threw his saddle on the gray, the soldier saddled the chestnut.
So what's the gray's name?
I don't know. The feller I got him from didn't tell me. I think I'll call him Ned. Now, that would be too much of an insult to the horse. I reckon I'll just call him Coyote. He kind of reminds me of one.
Well, this little mare is about as gentle as a lamb.
Yeah, she is, ain't she? She belongs to a friend of mine. Maybe I'll get around to giving it to her one of these days.
Will set out directly south, taking his time, letting the gray set his own pace for much of the distance between Fort Larned and the point where he would strike the Arkansas. Once he struck the river, he'd follow it until he was directly east of Fort Dodge. When he reached that point, he would have to make a decision. Although the fort was on the river, the Arkansas took a wide turn before curving back to the west where the fort was located. It was a sight shorter to take a shortcut across the bend in the river, but if he was going to Camp Supply, he'd leave the river and continue due south. He tried to tell himself that he was in no hurry simply because he wanted to take it easy on the horses and let the gray and himself get to know each other. The fact of the matter, however, was that he'd still not made up his mind whether to stop by Fort Dodge or bypass it and go directly to Camp Supply. That little mare that he had in mind to present to Emma seemed to be gentle enough without a lot of work on his part.
Makes sense to go ahead and give it to her now, since I'm going to be so close to the fort.
He had to ask himself if the real motivation to stop was really simply to get the horse off his hands. Or was it just a morbid desire to witness the woman he thought he loved happily married to a man he despised? Well, he wouldn't reach the point directly east of Fort Dodge until nightfall, so he still had a little time to worry over it and decide which way to go in the morning. Lieutenant Braxton Bradley had returned to Fort Dodge to a hero's welcome. The entire post had turned out to welcome him back and hear the report of his fight to escape his Cheyenne captors and the heroic Battle of Walnut Creek that took Army Scout Will Kaysen's life. He described the treacherous attack by the three murderers and the gallant defense the two of them waged, fighting side by side until Kaysen went down with a bullet in his side and another in his shoulder. When he was certain that Will was dead, and after killing one of the three assailants, he took the opportunity to escape and make his way to Fort Larned. Hardly knowing what to think after so many days of uncertainty, Sarah Lawton greeted her fiancé with a fond embrace. Emma's response to the lieutenant's verification that Will was dead was to turn away.
Now we can get back to planning a wedding.
We can get married tomorrow.
Oh, no you don't, Lieutenant Bradley. You're not going to ruin our chance to have a big wedding. We don't get many opportunities like this. A wedding at a dreary post, and Sarah deserves a wedding she can remember. Besides, we're going to have a real wedding with a real preacher to tie the knot, and the chaplain's regular visit isn't until next Sunday.
Captain Tuttle, the chaplain at Fort Larned, made regular monthly visits to Fort Dodge since Dodge had none at the present time. And it just made sense to wait and let him perform the ceremony.
I guess we'll have to wait until Edna says we're ready.
Although she fashioned a pleasant smile for his benefit, inside, Sarah found that she was relieved to put the wedding off for now, even if for only a week. Deeply troubled by the news of Will's death, it was difficult to feel elation over the prospect of her coming nuptials. While others were in a celebratory mood over the prospects of a wedding, she could not escape the black cloud that Will's death had cast over her. Somehow, she had felt that Will would always survive. He was nothing if not a survivor. How could he be dead? If she had chosen to examine her feelings more closely, she might have realized that she'd been able to accept the news of Braxton's probable death when he had been reported missing far more calmly than this tragic news about Will. Braxton came to the wagon that night just as soon as he had finished his reports to his superiors. Sarah greeted him with a kiss on the cheek, even though it was obvious that he expected more. But he assumed that her less than passionate embrace was due to the presence of her 6-year-old daughter. He could not help but notice the lack of the usual enthusiasm in the child. She was quiet, hardly speaking a word, which was noticeably uncharacteristic.
Looks like about another week before you'll be my little girl. What do you think about that, Emma?
Don't call me Emma. My real name is Whiskers.
Oh. Well, I didn't know that. But I think I like Emma better for a pretty little girl like you. So I'll call you Emma.
My name's Whiskers.
Emma promptly left their presence to find seclusion in her bed in the wagon.
Are we going to have trouble with that child?
No. She's just fond of Will and misses him. She'll get over it before long.
Where'd she get that name? What was it, Whiskers? What kind of odd name for a little girl?
It's nothing. It's just a little nickname Will called her.
Will again. That man was an issue when he was alive. Am I going to have to put up with his ghost now with Emma?
The wedding day broke bright and clear with the promise of a perfect day for Braxton and Sarah. Emma lay awake in her bed beside her mother, staring up at the canvas top of the wagon. The night just passed would be her last one in the wagon. After the wedding, she and her mother would move into the small quarters prepared for them and her new father by the carpenters. Emma found that she was reluctant to leave the wagon, and she'd been awake since before sunup, thinking about her new life with her stepfather. Young as she was, she had a level head on her shoulders, and she resolved not to make the union difficult for her mother, in spite of her personal preferences. This was the second time she'd heard that sound since waking, and this time she decided to investigate. Moving as slowly and quietly as she could so as not to disturb her mother, she left the wagon and sneaked through the tent attached, hoping to surprise the varmint that was no doubt sniffing around their camp. Pushing the tent flap aside very carefully, she was at once astounded to find the noises had emanated from a brown and white paint pony. The horse was tied to the back wheel of the wagon, patiently standing, saddled and bridled. Emma, still in her gown, went out and looked for the rider. There was none that she could see. She walked all around the wagon and tent, still finding no one, so she went back to look at the paint again. It was then that she noticed a piece of paper tied with a length of rawhide cord to the saddle horn.
This horse is for Whiskers. She saddle broke and gentle.
The note was not signed. Emma's screams of joy brought Sarah out in a panic, thinking her daughter was in danger.
Emma?
Mama, it's Will! It's Will!
Confused and frightened that Emma's imagination had run rampant, she thought first to calm her hysterical daughter. But that was before spying the strange horse tied to the wagon wheel. When she saw it, she, like Emma had, looked around thinking to find the rider. When there was no one to be seen, she turned again to the excited child who was even then trying to climb up in the saddle.
Emma, get down from there. You'll get hurt. We don't know who that horse belongs to.
It's my horse, Mama. Will promised he would give me a horse of my own, and he kept his promise.
Emma, you're letting your imagination...
Look!
Emma thrust the note in her hand. Sarah felt as if her heart stopped temporarily as she read the words scrawled upon the back of a duty roster, evidently ripped off the bulletin board outside the orderly room. Feeling suddenly chilled inside, she tried to force her mind to make sense out of the appearance of the horse and the note, which defied reason. Will Kaysen was dead. Braxton had confirmed it, so where did the horse come from? Sarah was not a firm believer in things spiritual, but she couldn't dispel the eerie feeling visited upon her. At this point, Emma was her only source of information.
I told him I wanted my own horse, and he said he would give me one, but he told me not to tell you because you might not want me to have one. It was our secret, and he kept his promise.
Sarah was beside herself. She had no reason to disbelieve her daughter. Emma had never shown a tendency to make up stories. This incident was too bizarre to explain. She believed Emma when she said no one but she and Will had known of the secret promise they shared. For a moment, she considered that Braxton had made the gesture as a bridge between him and her daughter. Just as rapidly, however, she discarded the idea, simply because the note had said Whiskers and not Emma. With her mind in a quandary, she did not know what to do about the horse. However it arrived at her wagon, someone had obviously meant it as a present for Emma, so she could do nothing to solve the mystery until she talked to Braxton, or maybe Edna Boyle. Someone must know something about it. She wasn't ready to believe a ghost had left it there. A little while after breakfast, Edna Boyle came over to inform Sarah that the preacher had arrived late the night before from Fort Larned, and the ceremony could proceed as planned, with the actual vow scheduled to be exchanged at 2:00 that afternoon. She was taken aback when Sarah told her of the mystery pinto. Like Sarah, she could think of no reasonable explanation for its appearance at her wagon. Edna suggested that they should unsaddle it and let Emma lead it down to the water to drink. The horse seemed gentle enough, and they could watch from the campsite. It was while Emma was down beside the river with the mare that Braxton joined the two ladies. When told of the gift for Emma, his reaction was stony, and his ire was immediately turned upon the little girl watering the horse, as if it was her doing.
I'm sick of hearing about that damn ghost. I think you're gonna have to do something about your daughter's infatuation with that saddle tramp.
I think it's a little harsh to call Will a saddle tramp. He means a lot to Emma, and certainly to me, too. You must give Emma a little time to get over this.
I want that man out of our lives. If you're going to defend him every time his name's brought up, I don't see how that's going to happen. The man's dead. It's time for Emma and you to accept it.
I'm sorry, Braxton. Let's just give it a little time, and I think you'll understand Emma's attitude.
Hell, I will. I intend to find out who left his horse here and why.
Braxton was convinced that it was a ploy by someone opposed to the wedding to upset the ceremony, and his mind was already racing to come up with likely suspects. Principal among these were possibly Lieutenant Bordeaux and Corporal Kincaid of C Company. They were big friends of the civilian scout. a silent witness to the discussion to this point, Edna Boyle was beginning to have concerns about the chemistry between the bride and the groom. She was seeing a side of Braxton Bradley that had not surfaced before. A more pragmatic woman had never lived than Edna Boyle, so the thought that the ghost of Will Kaysen had delivered on a spiritual promise to the six-year-old never even gained a foothold in her mind.
If I can interrupt this lover spat for a moment, maybe we should talk to Captain Tuttle. He just came from Fort Larned. Maybe he knows something about the horse.
Begging your pardon, Mrs. Boyle, but this doesn't really concern you.
Oh, I think it does. Edna's my friend and is the one person most responsible for the whole wedding.
Very well. We'll go talk to Captain Tuttle.
Captain Leonard Tuttle was enjoying a leisurely cup of coffee with Lieutenant Bordeaux when Lieutenant Bradley and the two women walked in. Surprised to see the women in the officer's mess, the two immediately got to their feet while Edna introduced the Reverend to the wedding couple. Edna quickly explained that their impromptu visit had nothing to do with the wedding plans, but was merely an effort to solve a minor mystery about a horse. An interested bystander to the unusual circumstances that delivered the horse and note to Sarah Lawton's wagon, Lieutenant Bordeaux said nothing until Braxton made it a point to ask him directly whether he had anything to do with it.
No, Bradley, I didn't have anything to do with it. Why in the world would you think I did?
You and Kaysen were always pretty thick.
He was a damn good man. Begging your pardon, ladies.
The whole story did not add up to him. And the more he thought about it, the more he came to agree with the little girl's contention that Will gave it to her.
Tell me something, Bradley. You're the last person to see Will alive, right?
Yes.
Shot twice, you said. And you're absolutely sure he was dead before you left him on that creek bank?
Of course. You doubt my word?
I got a feeling that Will Kaysen was still alive when you left him.
I'm not sure I like what you're insinuating.
Astonished by the storm brewing between the two officers, Captain Tuttle offered a piece of information that had just then occurred to him.
There was a badly wounded civilian scout that arrived at the fort about a week ago. I heard that he had been in some kind of ambush, now that I recall. Could this possibly be the man you speak of?
He's alive! He's alive! I knew damn well he wasn't dead. Pardon me again, ladies. You left him on that creek bank to die.
There was only one horse. He told me to escape while I had the chance. He knew he was dying. I wouldn't have left him otherwise. Sarah, it made no sense for both of us to die. And I had you to think of. I had a responsibility to get back to you.
The confusion of emotions racing through Sarah's mind was almost too much for her to cope with. Contrasted with the elation over the sudden prospect that Will was alive was the sobering confession of the man she was intending to wed. Still able to keep a clear head, Edna Boyle was quick to grasp the turmoil going through the younger woman's mind. She took Sarah by the arm and pulled her toward the door.
Come on, darling. You need to get out of here and go someplace where you can think.
Wait, Sarah. We have to talk to the captain about the wedding.
I'm not sure there's going to be a wedding.
Lieutenant Bordeaux went at once to find Captain Fisher, his company commander. It took a few minutes' time to explain the whole affair to Fisher, but the captain readily understood the lieutenant's intent. With Fisher's blessing, Bordeaux went in search of Corporal Kincaid. He found him in the process of instructing a group of new recruits in the care and feeding of their horses. After hearing what Bordeaux wanted him to do, Kincaid immediately went to saddle his horse. In a matter of minutes, he dismounted beside the brown and white paint pony at the rear of Sarah's wagon. Kincaid was not the tracker Will Kaysen was, but he was a far sight better than most. It could also be said that he was not a deep thinker, but he was smart enough to put two and two together and come up with an appropriate answer. He had suspected that Will's recent comments about quitting the scouting business and settling down to a more steady life had something to do with a particular woman. After hearing Bordeaux's report on the discussion at the officers' mess, he was eager to get the news to Will, just in case he had been accurate in his speculations. Evidently, Bordeaux was of the same opinion, else why would he have sent him to find Will? He couldn't imagine his superiors going to this much trouble over finding the person who left a horse tied to a civilian's wagon. But Will Kaysen was not the average person. He took a moment to look the Pinto over just to satisfy natural curiosity to see what kind of horse she was. Nodding his approval, he then examined the horse's hooves in case there might be some irregular marks that would make tracking easier. There were none, although the horse would probably need new shoes before very long. Kincaid had a pretty good notion that Will was heading to Camp Supply. All he was looking for now was verification of that, and an indication of the trail he took. In spite of the difficulty of tracking in the grassy river plain, he found the tracks leading into camp, but none going back out. That indicated to him that Will had walked into the camp leading the mare, so as not to make any noise. Then he walked out again to some point where his horses were waiting. He backtracked the mare's hoof prints to that point and verified his belief that Will had headed south toward Camp Supply.
Looks like we got company, Coyote.
Will walked over to the saddle on the ground and pulled his rifle from the scabbard. He'd stopped to make camp early in the afternoon, figuring that his horses needed a good long rest.
Maybe we should have gone on to Bluff Creek.
The stream he had stopped beside offered scant protection, other than a screen of berry bushes and brush. So he moved a few yards away from the horses and knelt behind a gooseberry thicket to await his visitor. Though still several hundred yards distant, he was soon able to identify the rider as a soldier and riding hard. After a few minutes, he smiled.
Corporal Kincaid.
He lowered his rifle and remained kneeling where he was, watching his friend as he pulled up short to take a closer look at the camp before riding in.
Sure would be easy to pick you off, Kincaid. You're lucky I ain't a Cheyenne warrior.
Well, a Cheyenne wouldn't have pitched his camp on that little creek where everybody could see it.
Kincaid rode on in and dismounted.
I did take a second or two before I made up my mind when I didn't see that big bay of yours. I thought I might have rode up on somebody else's camp. You're looking pretty spry for a dead man.
Spades didn't make it from Walnut Creek. Where the hell are you going in such a big hurry? I thought somebody was chasing you.
Well, I was looking for you. Sorry to hear about your horse. What happened to him? Any coffee left in that pot?
What were you looking for me for? Ned Spike shot him. And there's a little left, enough for a cup.
Kincaid emptied the remains of the coffee into his cup and found a place to sit down near the stream.
Lieutenant Bordeaux sent me to find you. Set off a real storm when you left that little paint by Sarah Lawton's wagon.
How so?
It'd been a whole lot simpler if you'd told somebody you were leaving it. Hell, man, we thought you were dead. There's people thinking a ghost brought that horse and tied it there. Nobody knew you survived that mess at Walnut Creek. Most anybody knew was what Lieutenant Bradley told him, and he said you was dead.
He did he? Well, he was pretty nigh right. But I don't see why that stirred up all the fuss about the horse.
You don't see what I'm getting at, do you?
Kincaid went on then to paint the picture for him, relating the scene when Captain Tuttle told him Will was still alive, and Bordeaux's accusation that Braxton had deserted a wounded man.
Here's the icing on your cake. Sarah called off the wedding.
What's that got to do with me? It ain't no icing on my cake.
Oh, the hell it ain't. I ain't got but two stripes on my sleeve, but I ain't stupid. I know you've been thinking about that woman ever since you brought her into Fort Dodge. You better decide what you're gonna do and make your move before somebody beats you to it. That's what I think.
I thought you weren't paid to think.
Will thought about what Kincaid had just told him. He tried to sort things out in his mind. Just because Sarah had decided she couldn't marry Braxton, there was no reason to assume she wanted to marry him or anybody else. Most likely, she would simply choose to return to the east as she had originally planned. It didn't occur to him that Bordeaux must have sent Kincaid to find him for some reason, when there was no official purpose as far as his scouting duties were concerned. In the end, he decided that Sarah was more than likely in a state of devastation caused by the sudden turn of events. And since it seemed he was a major party in the cause of her destroyed plans, she might not be receptive to seeing him at all. The more he thought about it, the more he came to believe that any attraction Sarah might have had for him was wholly created in his mind. She'd never said anything or given any real indication that she regarded him as more than a friend. And the rest, well, that was just wishful thinking. He decided that it would be best to wait a spell before seeing Sarah again. Give her a chance to decide what she wanted to do.
I appreciate you riding all the way out here to tell me, but I expect Sarah will do what she wants to do. And I've got to report back to Camp Supply right away. I expect Ben Clark might have already fired me by now.
The following week was a troublesome one for Will Kaysen. Ben Clark noticed the difference in attitude from that of the usually unperturbed scout. There was certainly no slackening of his work ethic. In fact, he seemed to volunteer for every damn patrol that left the post. He even stepped up to muster for Lieutenant Bridges' patrol, although Bridges rejected him. The first week back from Fort Dodge turned into 2, and then 3 weeks, with still no change in the scout's stoic, moody disposition. Sensing a discontent in Will's demeanor, Clark decided to give him a change of scene. Ordinarily, the chief scout could care less what personal demons might be bothering one of his men, as long as it didn't interfere with the job. But Clark had always held a special interest in Will ever since he signed on as a scout. So on a Saturday afternoon, Clark went out in search of him, with a fair idea where he might find him. Will tossed down his third shot of rye whiskey and waved Mickey's hand off when the bartender lifted the bottle to refill his glass.
I expect that's all the whiskey I need right now.
Ben Clark was not the only person at Camp Supply to notice the somber change in the rangy scout's attitude. Lula McGraw, standing at his elbow, had sensed it as well. Still, it had not impeded her constant campaign to bed the indifferent young man.
Yeah, Mickey, he's had all the whiskey he needs. Now he needs something else, don't you, darling?
Will didn't answer at once. He turned to gaze at Lula for a long moment. This woman had been trying to lure him into the back room for more than a year, and he'd always resisted her advances. Why? Lula was nothing to look at, but underneath her painted exterior there could be a compassionate heart. Why he had never seen fit to answer his more primal needs was something he had never given much thought about when it came to Lula. After thinking about it for a moment, he decided he might as well donate $3 since she'd been pressing so long for his business.
All right.
You mean it?
I reckon.
Lula looked at Mickey briefly, then back at Will, waiting for the joke.
You ain't fooling with me, are you?
Will fished in his pocket for the $3 and put it on the bar.
You want the money or not?
With no further hesitation, she swept the money from the bar with one hand and grabbed his hand with the other.
Come on, darling, before you change your mind.
He let himself be led toward the door to the back room where Lula conducted her business. There was no desire on his part to complete the transaction, and he wondered now why he had agreed to it. Fact of the matter was, he just didn't care one way or the other. And that was obvious to the point where Lula picked up on it. causing her to pause in the process of removing her frock.
Well, you ain't exactly chomping at the bit, are you?
Lula laid her dress across the foot of the bed and stood there studying him for a moment, still in her petticoat.
Something's eating at you.
Nothing.
Will made a half-hearted attempt to unbutton his shirt. She reached up and stopped him with her hand on his, realizing at that moment exactly what the problem was.
It's a woman, ain't it? You done gone and fell in love with somebody. And it ain't gone the way you want it to, is it?
No, it's no such thing.
Well, the hell it ain't.
Lula sat him down on the bed and seated herself beside him. And for a moment, she simply sat there gazing at his face, studying the boyish longing that had remained hidden beneath the rugged profile.
What are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
Will was reluctant to talk about it, but under pressure from a compassionate Lula that he never would have guessed existed, he finally told her the reason for his melancholy.
Well, as much as I hate to admit it, this ain't gonna help it none.
Lula got up from the bed, took the $3 from the chest by the bed, and handed it back to him.
Go on back up to Fort Dodge and tell her how you feel. That's the only way you're gonna find out how she feels about it. Y'all were that.
You keep the money. You earned it. And more, I reckon.
Yeah, well, get on out of here before I remember who the hell I am.
Will held the spotted gray gelding to a businesslike gait, heading north. He had decided to take Lula's advice with or without Ben Clark's permission, but the chief scout had met him minutes after leaving Mickey's saloon with word that he was sending him to Fort Dodge. Ben told him that Colonel Arnold had been requesting his services for quite some time, and he decided that he would let him go for a while.
Now, it's temporary, and I expect you back here in a couple of months or so.
So, at least he hadn't lost his job over his personal problems. His chief worry now was whether he was too late to let Sarah know his mind.
It's probably too damn late.
His first reaction was one of elation when he approached Fort Dodge late in the afternoon and saw the wagon still parked by the river. Then the thought wormed into his mind that maybe the wedding was back on. It was enough to cause him to hesitate before approaching the wagon, wondering if he should report into the orderly room first. But that notion was immediately discarded. Although it was surely supper time, he saw no one about the tent or wagon. Sarah's two horses and Emma's paint were grazing nearby, all three hobbled. Whiskers doing, he figured. Inside the tent, Sarah realized that she was late in starting supper. She started to call Emma to put some wood on the fire, but she decided to leave her where she was, playing in the wagon with her dolls. Stepping outside, she paused to breathe in the air for a moment. Glancing toward the river, she was startled to see what she thought at first was her mind playing tricks on her. But as the illusion became real, she suddenly felt a feeling of calm flow over her body.
Will.
As he pulled the gray up before the wagon, their eyes met in silent greeting. But the spell lasted for only a brief moment before Emma, suddenly aware, burst from the tent in a bubble of excitement.
Will! Mama, it's Will!
I know.
Sarah smiled as she stood and watched Emma clamoring to be picked up, almost before he had time to dismount.
Come here, Whiskers.
Oh.
Hey!
Hi, Will.
Sarah? I thought you might have been gone before I could get back. Reckon there haven't been any trains going back east.
There was one last week, but Emma and I decided to stay here a while longer. You're just in time for supper. I was just getting ready to start it.
Sarah smiled at Emma.
Put some more water in the coffee pot, honey. You know how Will loves coffee.
Oh, yes, ma'am!
Emma started to do her mother's bidding, then paused.
Where's Fates?
I'll tell you about him later. We got a lot of time to talk.
Once again, embracing the peace that his presence always brought her, Sarah silently agreed. There was time to talk, and time to let things happen the way fate intended. War Cry is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2010, Charles G. West. Published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of the Penguin Group USA Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication prohibited. Performed by Mort Shelby, Matthew Bassett, Thomas Keegan, Nora Ashrati, Tim Getman, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael Glenn, Bradley Smith, Scott McCormick, David Coyne, David Harris, Alyssa Wilmoth, Danny Gavigan, Eric Mesner, Jeff Allen, Terrence Aselford, James Lewis, Ken Jackson, Lily Beacon, Nick DePinto, Dylan Lynch, Colleen Delaney, and Richard Rowan. Additional Boot Hill Boys by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Thomas Hogan and Justin Wirtz. Graphic audio sound design by Thomas Hogan. Additional music by Thomas Hogan and Johann Detweiler. War Cry theme music by Thomas Hogan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed War Cry, be sure to listen to Charles G. West, Storm in Paradise Valley, Tanner's Law, Luke's Gold, and the Blackfoot Trail. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it. You just cannot stay out of trouble for any time at all, can you, boy?
Preacher, you sure have good timing.
I always have. Might have showed up a few minutes earlier, though, since you only left one of the varmints for me to kill.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, number 3, The Violent Land.
Preacher, it is so good to see you again.
Well, it is mighty good to be here.
I'm glad the two of you were able to make it here today. I have a big supper planned.
While you two were flapping your gums, that varmint was about to shoot Preacher in the back.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Matt. I figured you'd take care of him.
What if I hadn't been paying attention?
Well, I knew you would be. Smoke and meat taught you well enough.
Where'd you say you were from?
Germany. Prussia, to be precise.
What's this about a wagon train?
Baron Friedrich von Hoffmann is our leader. He's taking a large group of settlers to the American states called Wyoming. The Baron has bought a ranch there and intends to establish a town as well.
Sounds like a fellow with big plans.
Oh, help! We gotta do something, Smoke. The Baron's had guards posted, but they won't be expecting something like that.
That's why you've got to get around them and warn everybody at the Raptor 9. Your horse is just as fast as mine or Preacher's, and you can organize a defense. There's no time to waste.
What about the two of you?
We're going to follow them. When they attack the ranch, we'll hit them where they least expect it. From behind.
Damn right we will. We'll have those varmints in a trap right where we want them.
It can't be.
I'm about to ride up there and see for myself. Want me to have the boys saddle a horse for you so you can come along with me?
Damned right I do. I want to see this with my own eyes.
It'll mean going onto that foreigner's range.
I don't give a damn about that. Pick out a dozen men to ride with us and tell them to be ready to fight.
Come on, Bat! We'll cover you!
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Who the hell are you?
I'm the law. And if you pull that pistol, I'm going to shove it up your ass and pull the trigger.
Graphic Audio presents Shootout at Broken Bow.
Put that thing back in your boot. It's time for you to call it a night, get your money off the table, and clear out of here. Maybe you'll have better luck tomorrow. Kind of an unfriendly way to greet customers.
Well, I'm sorry, mister, but the past few days around here has got a lot of folks kind of edgy when a stranger walks in.
You stay away from my wife!
I don't think so.
Oh, no! Oh!
Shut up!
He was here. Him and three of his boys.
How long ago?
He left here 2 nights ago.
Did he say where he's headed?
Nope, but I didn't ask him.
Did you see which way he headed when he left here?
Yeah, I watched him leave. He started out to the north following Boggy Creek.
So you found us. What are you aiming to do about it, seeing as how it's your gun again, our four?
Well, that's just it, damn it. If you'd gone the hell back to Texas after you robbed that train at Durant Station, it wouldn't have caused me no problem. But now I ain't by myself. I expect in about 10 or 15 minutes it's gonna be somebody on that hill above us that ain't looking for no payoff.
My God, somebody's gonna pay for this. If I have to ride into Fort Smith and shoot that judge right down in his damn courtroom. It pleasures me to know that you're looking out for us.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.